Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit UCTV.tv/stemcell.
All right. Well, thank you for being at our Medicine Informing Novel Discoveries events. These are getting a momentum of their own. So we like to be mindful of what a team effort this has been. So I wanted to thank Kirsten in the back here for always championing these events, which are not that easy to put together, but you can see a lot of people are getting interested. We have Michelle Ortigara just came in. She's our Sanford Stem Cell Institute director, executive director. I'm the director of the Sanford Stem Cell Institute for the six centers, the Brain Tumor and Neural Restoration Program, most of which are actually represented here. So if you're part of the Sanford Stem Cell Institute, including my lab over here, please put up your hand. Okay, so you're surrounded, as you see. If you're from a philanthropic or charitable group, okay. If you're from industry, and then if you're a UCSD staff, alumnus, yes. Okay, I think we've covered just about the whole audience. If you're a patient advocate, yes. So we're in for a real treat today. So I'm Katrina Jameson, I go by Kat. We're thrilled to have the speaker lineup that we have today. This is the Mover and Shaker group. These are the improbable discoveries that actually led to really impactful clinical trials for the toughest diseases to target. These are rare diseases. And, you know, I study rare diseases. I study myeloproliferative neoplasms in my clinic. These affect 1 per 100,000 people. But this is even rarer than that. And they're correctable diseases, provided you think carefully about how you're going to fix the problem. But first, as we know, there's an odyssey to having the proper diagnosis to begin with. So we'll be talking about the proper approach to diagnosis and treatment for some of these inherited disorders. We live in the land of Rady Children's Hospital, so we're thrilled to be able to work very closely with Rady's and UC San Diego Health and all the scientists around us who tend to think they want to do things for their discoveries and put them in the clinic. We'll be hearing from Stephanie Cherkey and her New England Journal paper that was just published regarding what I thought was the toughest trial to ever get off the ground, and somehow Stephanie did this with her team. Betty Cabrera was instrumental in this, but it's an example of how individuals can make a difference, individually as scientists, as administrators, but also as a family that say, you know what, we're going to step up for this. Then we'll hear from Lisa Kadike from CIRM. It matters that we have the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine helping to navigate this difficult path, whether it's through diagnosis or therapy or both, so we can have better diagnostics, better therapeutics that match the patient as opposed to match the therapy. So Lisa Kadike will talk about that. Leo Wang is here from City of Hope. Leo is a fellow Alpha Clinic director. So we're thrilled that Leo is here. I first met him because he worked with Amy Wagers, and I knew her from postdocing, but Leo has just taken on a whole zeal about developing therapies for pediatric cancers and particularly around brain tumors. So we'll hear about that. Then we're going to have a patient story with a very strong patient advocate who's here. So Daphne will tell us about her daughter's story and how that's going. So here we're doing what other people would consider improbable or impossible. So why is that? Because we have you. We have you never, ever, ever giving up on the idea that we can find solutions to these difficult problems, even if it takes that awkward part where we don't actually know what we're doing and we figure it all out together. And that's where we combine our strengths. So we're going to have Stephanie Cherkey come up and talk about her studies. Stephanie is really the pioneer of not just gene therapy for this rare disease called cystinosis, but actually the whole methodology for making this platform technology that we can use more commonly. She's a professor here in pediatrics. We work closely with her team in the Sanford Stem Cell Institute. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Kat, for the introduction. Thank you for being here. So I want to say a story, because we say, okay, gene therapy for rare disease, but how many, each time it's like, how many patients is there? How many patients do you treat? So, okay, it's like 3,000, 5,000, you know, 10,000. And you think, oh yeah, there are so many people who have cancer or like diabetes. And you know, I wanted to say, and I hope I will show you today, that working on rare disease, first of all, it's important because when you are a parent who have a kid who is dying from a rare disease, it's very important to, you know, have scientists who care and will work on it to find new treatment. But I want to show you more. I want to show you that working on rare disease can also teach us so much that we will apply that to so many more diseases. So that's the story I want to say. So I am a professor in the pediatrics department at UCSD, and that's my disclosure that I always have to do. So what is a rare disease? You know, so usually a rare disease affects our gene. You know, most of them are affecting our gene. And so you just need a little bit of one mutation, like one faulty base pair in your DNA, and you might not walk. And you might just die, you know, because of this faulty gene. And we have like most of them affect, you know, children, and you have like a poor quality of life for many years, and eventually die as an adult. You have more than 7,000 rare diseases. So put together, there are more than 400 million people affected with rare disease. So this number alone is important because, again, the tool and technology that we are developing for rare disease, it will be true for not only one disease, it will be true for so many other diseases. And that's the key that we want to understand here. And so what is a gene therapy? So when for many of these diseases that affect the gene, most of the time, drug don't do much because, as I said, the gene is affecting so many parts of your body and so many heart function of your cells that a drug can it would be very hard to replace that. So the gene therapy is to act on the gene, is to treat, the medicament is to treat the gene, to, you know, replace the faulty base pair, the mutation, or replace the gene. And so you have two ways of doing that. You can just add the gene to the body, you know, by, you know, using a viral vector. So, you know, we are using the virus that exists in our system, you know, like we use, you know, AAV vector, HIV vector, you know, things that are usually bad, we make them good. And they are the one that will bring the healthy genes to the body. Or you have ex vivo gene therapy. And that's the way I'm using it, so for disease. So the in vivo gene therapy is usually good for a disease that affects only one tissue, the brain, the eye, the liver. But when you have disease, like one gene is impacted, but all your organs are affected, then the ex vivo gene therapy is probably the best when they use our own bone marrow stem cells. And why? Because our bone marrow stem cells, what they will do if you have an injury, they will travel to the injury and try to fix it. So it's a great vehicle to try to fix the gene that is missing. And that's what we are using. So in my lab, we are using the bone marrow stem cells, our own stem cells that we have in the bone marrow, and create blood cells to repair them and make them as a vehicle to bring the gene to all the organs. And so, again, I don't have a long time, so that's why I'm really summarizing the long story in one slide. But I started to work on cystinosis when I was a PhD, and I got that, you know, from one of my committee members saying, "Why are you working on a so rare disease?" You know, and I'm like, I said, you know, it could be very important, and I hope he would be in the room today to see how. What we've done and what we've learned with this disease. So it's a disease that affects one children out of 200,000 births. And it's a gene that is not secreted. So it's a protein that is really inside the cells. So it makes it even more difficult. And the patient develops everything. Kidney failure, blindness, muscle weakness, diabetes, you name it. So you can imagine the poor quality of life of these children. And they have a drug that they have to take every day, every 6 hours, even at night, around the clock, and it smells bad, and they have side effects, and they still die from the disease. So there is a need for better treatment, and this is what I wanted to do. And again, it was a really worst kind of model disease for gene therapy, and that's why I use the hematopoietic stem cells. And so we started, you know, the idea of using these bone marrow stem cells in 2007. We did, you know, the mouse model I created during my PhD. We used them, and we could treat them and rescue them. And I was like, wow, that's why you live, you know, and you do research every day. And that was our first proof of concept was in 2007. And then I knew I really wanted to go to clinical trial, and I got the first meeting with the FDA in 2012. And fast forward, you know, we developed all the technology that, as you know, Kat said, can be a platform for many diseases, and to add the gene, you know, to the stem cell and put back into the patient. And here we have Jordan, our first patient, who was treated in 2019, more than 6 years ago. And Jordan today is now living his life, is doing, you know, he went back to the studies now, has a great job. And he said that for the first time of his life, he spent days without thinking about cystinosis, whereas before this was all his life. And so that was our success. And, you know, actually we published last month in New England Journal of Medicine, which is the best journal of medicine in the world. So, you know, even a rare disease can be published in good journals, so that's great. But also the other success was that, you know, Novartis acquired this program, and now is starting the same technology in kids with cystinosis. But what I want to say and want to stress the fact is that this was possible because we received money from the Cystinosis Research Foundation, because nobody, NIH would have never put a dime into these ideas at the beginning, but that created great data, and now after I got NIH. But I want to say a big thank you to CIRM, because if I was able to do the whole bench to bedside as an academic researcher, it's because of CIRM, California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, that is giving grant to, you know, even academic researcher to be able to do this and bring to the clinic. So now I will go, you know, faster on that was my, you know, first baby, you know, I would say. But what we've learned about it is like, how comes bone marrow stem cells that do blood cells can rescue a disease like cystinosis with all the organs degenerating, the protein not secreted? And what we discover is actually the stem cells become some immune cells in the body, and they create these tunneling nanotubes with transfer of a lysosome with the protein. And that was the new discovery, how we could, you know, engineer hematopoietic stem cells in vitro, and they could be, you know, this great reservoir of a protein and that of healthy cells and bring the protein everywhere. So based on this, we were like, okay, so if I can do that on cystinosis, then I could do that on many other disorders. And so this is what we are doing now. We are now working on Danon disease because it's the same kind of, the same family of disease, which is called lysosomal disease with transmembrane protein. And so we are doing that in collaboration with Dr. Adler. And the kid have required heart transplant. So, you know, hopefully we will be able to avoid that one day. We are working on Sanfilippo syndrome C, which is a neurodegenerative disorder. And this is Rafael, the postdoc in my lab, who is leading this project. But I wanted to go further, and I wanted to apply that on other kind of disease, because this tunneling nanotube can transfer lysosome, but also mitochondria. And so that's, I went to another kind of disease, which is Friedreich ataxia. And it's also a terrible disease where the kids just have like an imbalance at the beginning, but little by little, they lose the locomotor ability and end up in a wheelchair for 5-10 years. And they eventually die from heart defect. And so we did the same principle, you know, and used hematopoietic stem cells, CRISPR-Cas9 to fix the gene. And now we could rescue completely the locomotor function of the mice. So it was really like they are like healthy mice. And so based on that, again, we went to the FDA. Again, it was first founded by the advocacy group, FARA, and NIH. And again, we got CIRM funding to be able to bring that to the clinic. And now we are doing the studies required by the FDA, and hopefully will be in a clinical trial next year. And now the last disease I want to talk about is, with everything we learn, and we were able to rescue the neurodegenerative disorder, like, you know, Friedreich ataxia, we were like, okay, if we can do that, why not going to Alzheimer? Because the hematopoietic stem cells maybe are powerful enough to help a disease like Alzheimer, which is much more prevalent, right? So then we tried, and again, from in my lab, it's a go, no go. I mean, we treat the mice and we look at how they behave. And it has to be obvious. And it was really obvious. I mean, you can, you know, again, it's a lot of things, but the memory function was completely restored in these mice after one treatment. And so now we are trying to bring this project again to a clinical translation and bring it to the clinic and treat Alzheimer. And I hope I will do that one day, because I really want to bring the message out there that treating rare disease is important. It's important for the family, it's important for the patients, for the kids, but also we learn so much that we can treat much more disease down the line. And I will just finish by, you know, donations are also very important, because that's how you, you know, you can start this kind of crazy idea that, you know, nobody would bet on, you know, because they want to have concrete results, and you cannot create these results if you don't have funding. And so that's why, you know, we created the Gene Therapy Initiative, you know, with a philanthropy money from Nancy and Jeff Stack here at UCSD. And we are trying to, and we are providing a seed grant to all the researchers at UCSD who have great idea with gene therapy on rare disease to be able to treat them. And we are supporting that by educating, accelerating, and by partnering. And on that, I hope I was on time. And I want to thank you for your attention.
All right, fantastic. So that was amazing. You know, I remember, Stephanie, when you first presented that work on stem cells can traffic to the brain because they're looking for sites of injury, it was heretical. People said, no, no, hematopoietic blood-forming stem cells cannot get to the brain. And then the whole nanotube idea was also mind-blowing. So it's been a very exciting journey to watch that. We're here, thanks in large part, to T. Denny Sanford as well. So I wanted to mention the power of individuals to really make a difference. So he's really invested in all of us working together. Lisa Kadek has come all the way from CIRM. Thank you for being here. She's a champion for rare diseases. And I wanted to underscore this point that Stephanie made. If you look at cancer, 30% of all cancers are rare. If you look at how cancer was revolutionized in terms of treatment, the first molecularly targeted therapy was for one of the rarest forms of cancer, chronic myeloid leukemia, 1 per 100,000 people diagnosed annually. So I always thought rare diseases are important, but clearly that's how we make inroads, by establishing platform technologies as Stephanie has done, and by having champions like you here. Thank you, Lisa, for being here and guiding the way so we can use these as platforms to tackle really tough diseases that just weren't fixable before. So thank you for being here. From CIRM.
Okay, thank you. And thanks to the organizers for inviting me to represent CIRM at this event. Happy to be here. And so I'm just going to give you a little bit of overview about CIRM. I know many of you are familiar, but may not all know the whole history. I'm not going to go through the whole history, but I'll give you our origin story and some of our accomplishments. And then in the theme of today's meeting, I'm going to talk a little bit more about CIRM's role in funding gene therapy approaches to rare disease. And I think at the end, I want to end on a positive note of some of the more recent changes that I think are going to help accelerate rare disease therapy development and make it not only faster, but less expensive, I hope. So a little bit about CIRM. We were created by a ballot proposition here in the state of California back in 2004 that designated $3 billion in funding to be spent on stem cell research and development of stem cell-based therapies. This is at a time when the federal government was put a moratorium on new funding for embryonic stem cell-based research, and this was California's response to that. So then 16 years later in 2020, the first $3 billion was pretty much spent, and California voters again supported CIRM with another $5.5 billion of funding with Prop 14. Prop 14 had a couple differences with Prop 71. First of all, it had an earmark of $1.5 billion specifically for research and development for diseases of the central nervous system and brain. And I should say a lot of rare diseases fall into that category. And the other change was that CIRM could now fund gene therapy research in addition to stem cell-based research. So that gets us to where we are today. And so our mission is a mouthful, but it's trying to capture, you know, many of our mantras and important goals, which is to accelerate world-class science, to deliver transformative regenerative medicine treatments in an equitable manner to a diverse California and world. And so how do we address getting to that mission or accomplishing that mission? Well, CIRM funds several different aspects of the ecosystem for supporting therapy development from bench to bedside. And first and foremost would be the just the research and development discovery pipeline, which is shown on the top here, you know, going from foundational, we have program announcements funding foundational research, therapeutic candidate identification, preclinical research, which is often called, used to be called the Valley of Death because other agencies don't fund that very often. And then the whole gamut of clinical research from first-in-human trials all the way to pivotal trials and BLA filing with the FDA. So that's our core funding programs. But to support those funding, we also have infrastructure programs such as shared resource labs, GMP manufacturing facility network, importantly, the Alpha Stem Cell Clinic Network, which we have two of the program directors here, Dr. Jameson and Dr. Wong. And also, we've now started funding what we call community care centers of excellence. And these are meant to partner with the Alpha Clinics, which are, I should say, the clinics that really specialize in delivery of these advanced therapies, cell and gene therapies. The community care centers of excellence are located in other parts of the state that are really not that close to the Alpha Clinics. And the idea is to help democratize delivery of these advanced therapies beyond those centers of excellence that exist today. And then last but certainly not least, CIRM funds education and workforce development, everything starting at high school all the way through graduate school and clinical fellows. And we are intending then to be able to sustain the workforce, the scientists of the future, to carry on this work beyond what we're doing today. So this is just, you know, the numbers slide to give you an idea of our impact. Of the $8.5 billion combined between Props 71 and 14, we've spent a little over $4.6 billion. Funded over 1,400 projects, over 115 clinical trials. More than 4,300 participants have been in those clinical trials. And CIRM-funded projects have also been able to raise $25 billion or more than that of industry support between acquisitions and co-funding and so forth. So it is really has been a good return on the initial investment. But so beyond these numbers here, what is the impact on patients? And that's what we really care about. So now I want to talk a little bit more in depth about CIRM funding of gene therapies for rare diseases. We've funded 160 awards for gene therapy approaches to rare disease, including both, as Dr. Cherky mentioned, the in vivo therapies and then the ex vivo gene modified cell therapies that are then transferred back to patients. And I want to just tell you an illustrative story about this little boy here, Ronnie. So Ronnie was born in 2017 in the Sacramento area with a devastating, usually fatal, immune deficiency, X-linked SCID, severe combined immune deficiency. Basically, he didn't have an immune system and was really at risk of death. I mean, there are potential that he could have been cured with an allogeneic stem cell transplant, but that doesn't, you don't always have a donor, and that has comorbidities. But Ronnie was lucky in some ways. First, that he got that diagnosis early on with newborn screening. And second, CIRM was funding a clinical trial at UC San Francisco at that time to address X-linked SCID with a gene therapy approach. So Ronnie was enrolled in that trial. His blood stem cells were taken. The normal copy of the gene was inserted into the genome of the blood stem cells, and then the cells were transplanted back into his body, where they regenerated the hematopoietic system, and including a normal, healthy immune system. And in this picture, he's out on the beach. He can go out into the world just like any other kid. He has a normal, healthy system. He was cured. And in fact, more than 50 children have been cured of similar fatal diseases in CIRM-funded trials. So clearly, these sorts of therapies are really transformational, the difference between life and death here, and they really work. So where's the rub? Part of the problem is that getting funding, first of all, developing these therapies takes a long time, and it costs a lot of money, and there aren't that many patients that receive the therapies. So investors don't always want to invest in these because they don't see a return on investment. This is an area that the rare disease field has struggled with for some time. But I think I want to end on a positive note here, because I think there is momentum because of changes in technology and in regulatory innovations that is going to make gene therapy for rare diseases be much more accelerated and at lower costs. So I'm going to end with this last slide. As you can tell, I like pictures of incredibly cute little babies. So you may have heard of baby KJ. He was in the news last year, just about a year ago. And I just want to give a disclaimer. CIRM did not fund his treatment, but he was born in Pennsylvania with an incredibly devastating metabolic disorder caused by a single gene mutation that's normally expressed in the liver. And when his diagnosis was obtained, his doctor there, Dr. Rebecca Ahrens-Nicholas, and one of her colleagues, Kieran Misenuro, decided that they could work with a team of experts from across the country, I won't name them all, to develop a personalized therapy for him. They knew exactly what the mutation was, and they set a record by treating him at age 7 months. He went from diagnosis to treatment in 7 months. This normally would take 5 years, maybe, at minimum. It was amazing. You know, it wasn't easy. It was not cheap. But why is this important? Well, part of the reason is because the type of therapy is a CRISPR base editor therapy, and it's delivered into the body, so that makes it less expensive than some ex vivo therapy. And it's with a lipid nanoparticle. And basically, you can just change one tiny aspect of that therapy, which is the guide RNA, and treat a different disease. So it's a potential platform. You were mentioning platforms also. And so the team at CHOP has proposed to the FDA that they be able to then treat patients with a lot of other different, you know, related, they could have different mutations in the same gene, or they could have mutations in different genes in the same metabolic pathway, for example, and then all be tested in one single clinical trial instead of each one being tested in a separate trial. You can imagine how much time and money that would save. And the FDA in February came out with a guidance document sort of outlining their view of, you know, what would be required. It's called the plausible mechanism pathway to implement such a platform. I'm a little bit over time here, so I just want to say that CIRM has also jumped on this bandwagon, and we hear later this month where we're going to be posting a program announcement to fund exactly this type of a platform trial. It's called the RAPID program, and we're asking for applicants to propose treating multiple different diseases in this, you know, it's with leveraging the same preclinical data and then in a single clinical trial. So I think we have a lot of optimism for the future because of these new innovations. And with that, I would like to thank you for your attention.
Ah, that's ending on a very positive note. So science became more nimble, and so did clinicians and funders. Thank you so much for telling us about that RAPID program. I think what we're learning today is with advances in technology, we can do so much more for a combination of diseases. And what I've been sort of surprised by is how nimble the FDA has become, partly because our patients go there and are advocates for better therapy. Right, Andrew? Yes. And we'll hear more about how to do this even more effectively. We've got the Alpha Clinic director from City of Hope, Leo Wang. We've known each other for quite a while. Leo is not just an amazing, brilliant innovator, but actually somebody who brings us all together. I say, well, that's a huge problem. It'll never work. And Leo goes, no, I think we just need to talk to them. We'll all get together. So he's a peacemaker and makes everything look easy, even when it's hard, kind of like Stephanie. So thank you, Leo, for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor to be here. Tonight is great. I've never been to one of these before, but I love this theme of making the impossible possible. And you've already heard, you know, about several instances of really just doing impossible things, right? Curing children with these lethal single gene disorders, cystinosis, XSCID, also going from N of one, you know, bespoke therapies to platform trials and platform approvals. These are things that would have been impossible 3 years ago, 5 years ago, for sure. And I think it just highlights what we can do in this space, you know, whether it's for other disorders that don't have cures yet or larger indications. I'm a pediatric brain tumor doctor. When I first came to City of Hope, I had the opportunity to meet a mom. And in my office, she gave me this card. And this was a card that she used to hand out because her child had a lethal brain tumor known as DIPG, diffuse intrinsic pontine glioma. And this is a terrible and invariably lethal disease that steals kids' ability to move and to also to regulate their emotions. And so her daughter, Katie, would have these incredible outbursts in places like Target and Walmart, and all the other parents would judge the mom. Sort of like, well, how could you let your child do this? And so she had these business cards made out and made up, and she would hand them to parents or onlookers that she thought were being judgmental. And I have this in my office as a reminder of what we're doing, why we're doing this. I never got to meet Katie. Because DIPG is a terrible disorder, terrible disease, with a median survival from diagnosis to death of about 11 months. And if you saw in the card, it was 7 to 9 months at the time that Katie was diagnosed. And now it's 11 months. It is a rare disease. It's a rare disease, about 150 to maybe 400 patients a year diagnosed in the United States. It's a rare disease of the central nervous system. And it's a disease for which really the cure rates have not gone up in the past 50 to 60 years. And so it's, I think, currently an impossible disease, but there's a lot of optimism that we can make it possible. And one of the things that I work on is chimeric antigen receptor T cells. Those of you who are alumni of the MIND symposiums have listened to Dan Kaufman talk about this. And these are really just re-engineered immune cells that can target and kill cancer cells. So this is just a time-lapse photograph of that I got from my colleague and friend, Christine Brown, who really pioneered this work at City of Hope. What you're seeing here are brain tumor cells. Those are the sort of fried egg types of cells. And then around them, you're seeing really small, these are the re-engineered immune system cells. And when you reteach these immune cells to kill cancer cells, you can see that they do a phenomenal job of just killing them. And CAR T cells have really revolutionized the way that we think about and treat leukemia, lymphoma, blood cancers. And there's a lot of enthusiasm that they can also change the way that we think about solid tumors. As I said, fundamentally, this is reprogramming the immune system by inserting this chimeric antigen receptor that reprograms the T cells, in this case, to kill cancer cells. And then you take the cells, as Stephanie, as Dr. Turkey was explaining about ex vivo gene therapies. What you do is you take the cells out of the body, and then you expand them, you introduce this chimeric antigen receptor using a lentiviral vector, and then you expand them and put them back into the body. And when I moved to City of Hope almost 10 years ago, Christine and others at the institution had been working on chimeric antigen receptor therapy for leukemia and lymphoma. They'd started doing brain tumors, and they wanted to know if I would be interested in taking on this impossible task of bringing this to children with brain tumors. And I instantly said yes. We had this idea that we could use these therapies to treat children with these devastating brain tumors. And initially, when we went to apply for funding, people were like, that's impossible, that's crazy. You know, one of the things about these tumors is that they're in the brainstem often, which is the place in it's a connection between the brain and the rest of the body. And these tumors, if you cause them to swell, that swelling can be lethal. And so there had been in the field some pretty difficult experiences with immune therapies with some pretty bad toxicity. And so initially when we went to propose this, a lot of conventional funding agencies said, no, no way, that's impossible, we're not going to do it. And so fortunately, we were able to go to really forward-looking donors who said, you know, this is something we'd be interested in funding. And also, critically, we had the partnership of patients and patient families who said, look, we want the right to try this. There's nothing else available to us, and we recognize that there's a risk, but we're willing to do this with our eyes open. So when we combined the patient advocates and the donors, we were able to get enough money to start the trial. We were able to show that it was safe in two patients, and with that, we went to CIRM, and CIRM said, okay, we will fully fund your trial. And that was what allowed us to do this trial. So we owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to all of those people in getting this therapy to come sort of to fruition. What we've shown now, we've completed the first two cohorts of the trial, and we've shown that it is safe, it is well tolerated, and it works. So this is just some MRIs of a couple of patients. The top one is the one I want to focus on, who has this diffuse midline glioma. And you can see, you know, that this is a 14-year-old kid who came to us with this brainstem glioma, midline glioma. This white mass is his tumor. After four cycles of therapy, it really just shrank. It melted away. And this is accompanied by tremendous clinical improvement. When he came to us, he was very somnolent, which is not uncommon. He was sleeping about 22 hours a day. But by the time he left the hospital, he was sitting up in bed. He was joking with all the nurses. And, you know, he was able to go home. He had missed his prom because he'd been in the hospital. It was a eighth grade prom or whatever, and he was able to have that at his house, which was hugely gratifying for all of us, including his family. And his mom said to me, you know, you gave me my son back, which was an amazing gift to them and unhonested to all of us as well. This over here is just a waterfall plot showing that about 50% of the patients on the trial have some response. Their tumors shrink, and that's great. That's often accompanied by clinical response. This on the bottom is what's called a spider plot. So this just gives you a sense of how durable the responses. And the problem is that the responses are not particularly durable. Usually by about 8 to 12 weeks, the tumors have started growing again. And so this is sort of the next stage of impossible. This is the next thing that we need to tackle. But on the strength of those findings, we were able to expand our trial to two other sites around the country, in Michigan and in CHLA, Children's Hospital of Los Angeles. And this was also actually something that people thought was going to be impossible because it's very complex to make these cells and to ship them across the country, but we were able to do it. Okay, so what's the next thing? How do we get from 20? I should have mentioned that the median survival from diagnosis of the patients on our trial who had DIPG and DMG was 20 and a half months, which, you know, if you remember, I told you that normally it's 11 months. So that was great and is also very much in keeping with other major trials in the field. But 20 and a half months isn't cure. So how do we get the next level of impossible? And this is where we go back to the lab. So what we found in our trial is that actually children on these trials are developing immune responses to the chimeric antigen receptors, the CAR itself. Remember, I told you that this is an engineered protein. It doesn't exist in nature. And so what we're actually functionally doing is immunizing our patients against this new cell that we're introducing, the goal of which is to kill their tumor. And they're now mounting an immune response against the thing that we're putting in to try to help them, which is infuriating. Not just us, two other groups, Stanford and MGH, have also seen this. Initially, what we saw was that if you look in the cerebrospinal fluid, the CSF, of these patients as we're delivering these cells, some of them have very, very high levels of CAR T cells in their CSF and others don't. And it turns out that what we're seeing is anti-CAR antibodies in both the peripheral blood serum and in the cerebrospinal fluid. And in addition, sorry, I'm just going to skip through this quickly because we're running out of time. We identified T cell responses. So we actually have found specific expanded cytotoxic T cells in the CSF of these patients over the course of therapy. And they end up actually recognizing the CAR construct. So we need to figure out now how to mitigate that specific adaptive cellular and humoral immune response against the CAR. So that these CARs can sort of stick around and do what they're intended to do. So that's the next level of sort of impossible, but we have some pretty good ideas about how to do that, and that's something that I'd be very happy to talk to people about, you know, in the social hour. This is a very, very brief synopsis of a tremendous amount of work. This is just a very small portion of a very large clinical team. But a lot of this work started with Christine Brown, and we have collaborators at Michigan, CHLA, and a whole group of people who've done this, as well as our patients. It's just a track back to where the cells come from, just to demonstrate that those are what are called CD8 effector memory cells. So those are the ones that are killing things. So this is the acknowledgement slides for all of the people who've been doing this work, including our patients, their families, and their care teams. Really has been a tremendous amount of coordination and logistics to get this done. But I think that's sort of the sweet spot of where this field is and what this field requires in order to get impact to patients. And we really look forward to moving it forward in the next iteration. These are some of our scientific collaborators, CHLA, Texas, TGen in Phoenix, and in my lab as well. And then, of course, our patients, collaborators, colleagues, supporters, and we couldn't have done it without any of them. So thank you very much for your time.
Okay, so in the next couple of minutes, we'll hear from Daphne, a patient advocate. She is coming here to talk about the journey about how to get the proper diagnosis, get on a fundamentally important, impactful therapy that was quite bespoke and developed for her daughter. So we will move on.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for having me this evening. I'm here to talk about my four-year-old daughter, Harlow, who was diagnosed with TUB4A leukodystrophy in July of 2023. And I'm thrilled to say she just became the first female to be treated for TUB4A leukodystrophy in the world on October 15th. Mm-hmm. Carla was born. Everything was very typical. She went home, no NICU stay. At 15 months, we started to notice that her balance was off. She wasn't able to take independent steps. She fooled our pediatrician repeatedly because we went in and she was cruising around. It was effervescent and very bright, and like pointing to the animals on the wall and you know, saying their names. But once we did not see the progression in walking, eventually I had to fight to get an MRI and get a referral to neuro. Through that odyssey, the doctor, you know, seeing her, how she was able to move, how she was able to engage, they actually said, "Daphne, you know, do you think you might have some postpartum anxiety? Because I just had my third child." Like, no, you know, I know what this looks like. I have an older child. I've been around children all my life. So once we received the referral, there was about a 7-month wait. So we went and we got the MRI. That showed less than normal white matter. At that point, we received a referral for neurology, and I went on LinkedIn. And I wasn't willing to wait the 7 months. Not while I watched my child struggle. So I messaged every pediatric neurologist within a 6-hour drive of Southern Illinois at the time. And I was able to get in the next day with a neurologist at my alma mater, Vanderbilt. And she looked at the MRI and she said, "I'm going to request a leukodystrophy panel." And from looking on TikTok, from looking at all the social media apps, I had seen kids with leukodystrophy. And I just begged God, you know, please, whatever this is, don't let it be leukodystrophy, because I knew she was going to die. I knew what the path was. So we received the call on July 28th of 2023 that she was diagnosed with TUB4A hypomyelating leukodystrophy 6. She is 1 in 37 million. She's one of 300 kids in the world with TUB4A leukodystrophy. She is one of 6 with her particular variant. When we received that diagnosis, our doctor said, "You know, I'm Googling this in real time. Like, this is the first time I've ever heard of this disease." He referred us to CHOP, and then he said, "Well, and there's one more thing I'm going to mention. There was this nonprofit foundation that came to Vanderbilt 3 months ago called In Lorem. They may be able to help. I'm not sure, but that's a route that I would pursue." So 6 weeks later, I showed up here in San Diego at a Global Genes event that I knew In Lorem was going to be at, with a picture of my daughter, and I begged them to help me. And they agreed. They agreed. They told me I had to find a doctor. So then, yet again, I go out to LinkedIn, I go out to social media. I had over 600,000 eyes that saw my plea for somebody to please help me save my child. And Olivia Kim McManus here at Rady was the only one who said yes. So we packed up and we moved out to California with my 3 kids. And Harlow received her first dose on October 15th. Since we received the dose in the first 2 months post-dosing, she's completely potty trained. That was not the case before. A few weeks ago, she was standing up watching TV. She wasn't able to stand before. And it's still for a short period of time, but it's life-changing. She is walking with elbow crutches now. And I'm getting ready to show you a video of her riding her bike for the first time. What the people in this room do, it matters. It matters so much to families like mine. When the doctor told me that my daughter was going to die, I had the audacity, or maybe it was denial, I don't know, but I said, "Not my child." And without the help of people in this room, I know what her fate would have been. And at this point, we are praying that with this ASO, it will stop the progression of the disease. And then I have to figure out next steps. Because when she woke up, right there after receiving her first dose, the first thing she said to me is, "Mama, can I walk yet?" And darn it, I'm gonna find a way. I'm gonna find a way. And if it has to be stem cells, whatever we have to do, I will find a way. So thank you. Thank you for all that you do. Rare disease research matters. I know personally. Let me show you Harlow, riding her bike for the first time. Go, baby, go, baby, go. Go, baby, go, baby, go. Push, push, push. Can you go fast? I don't think you can go fast. I don't think you can go fast. I don't think you can go fast. Thank you.